Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 22. The Second Edition. It would be a mistake to suppose that all the days of these years of Mrs. Eddy's life, or indeed any years of her life, were characterized by gloom and anxiety. From the good and often amazing results later achieved, it is clear that in these early days, a great deal of confident and satisfying work was being done, and that the compensation of such successes, small or great, must have gone a long way to relieve the pressure of apparent failure elsewhere. Bronson Alcott had followed up his first interest with several kindly acts. He received both George Berry and Daniel Spofford in his home in Concord, visited Mary several times in Lynn, on one occasion at least stopping overnight in order to remain to the close of a session with her students. At another time, when some specially violent attack on science and health had come to his notice, he set out for Lynn and characteristically announced himself to Mary when he arrived with the words, "I have come to comfort you." Years afterwards, Mrs. Eddy recalled the incident, adding how his conversation, with a beauty all its own, reassured her. At another time, Bronson Alcott wrote to her from Concord, telling her how Mrs. Emerson had expressed a wish to meet her, and how he had commended herself and her book to respectful consideration to some of our best people, adding with remarkable insight, "I judge your worst opponents will be found among professing saints and worthless men." All of which must have been a great help and encouragement. Nevertheless, the road was rough enough. The lull in the storm which followed her marriage to Gilbert Eddy was hardly more than momentary. George Berry was completely irreconcilable, and within a few weeks he had brought suit against Mrs. Eddy to recover the sum of $2,700, which he said was due him for services rendered over a period of 5 years. His bill of particulars went into the smallest detail. Even the errands which he had shown himself so willing to run, and the small services he had apparently been glad to render, were all charged for. He put a price on his judgment in selecting carpets and furniture, and on his time in going to the bank for money or in paying the house rent. These, together with the more reasonable demands for compensation in the work of copying her manuscripts. The monetary consideration, although serious enough, was small compared with the anxiety and disappointment which the whole episode occasioned Mrs. Eddy at a time of great stress and uncertainty. She was working hard on the second edition of her book, and seeking at the same time to straighten out the ever more entangled problem of Spofford's dealing with the first. At length, she could apparently stand the strain no longer, and decided to put an end to it by going away for a time and leaving no address behind her. And so, one day early in March, she and Gilbert set out together, and without disclosing their plans to anyone, took train for Fairhaven in Connecticut on a visit to Gilbert Eddy's brother, Washington Eddy, who was married and had a home there. On the eve of her departure, she wrote to Spofford, but carried the letter with her to Fairhaven and did not mail it until some time after her arrival. Like several other letters written about this time, it was pervaded by a sense of strain and fear. Quimby's doctrine of penalty died hard, and she had still the most incredible depths of suffering to plumb before she could reach the point she did later, when she realized, as she put it, that the belief and the believer are one, that no belief can go further than thought permits. Even as early as 1881, she could write, looking back on these days, "In years past, we suffered greatly for the sick when healing them. That is all over now, and we cannot suffer for them." But in 1877, she was suffering for them, and not only for the sick, but for many other misconceptions from which she was later to shake herself free. Her letter to Spofford when she was leaving Lynn is almost pathetic in its burden. "The book lies waiting, but those who call on me mentally in suffering are in belief killing me, stopping my work that none but me can do. The book must stop. I can do no more now, if ever. They lay upon me suffering inconceivable." Later on, she wrote in another letter that whenever she tried to concentrate on her work of writing, she felt the demand of those who needed healing as sensibly as a hand, and towards the end of the letter declared wretchedly that if it were not for her husband, she would gladly yield up the ghost of this terrible earth plane and join those nearer my life. But whenever Mary Baker or Mary Patterson or Mary Baker Eddy reached such depths, it was invariably the signal for a tremendous rebound. Neither was this reaction any ordinary reaction. It almost always meant for her the attainment of a new height. As she was to put it years afterwards in one of her articles, "First, purify thought, then put thought into words, and words into deeds, and after much slipping and clamoring, you will go up the scale of science." She slipped and clamored more than enough in these early days, and she never hesitated to admit it. But the general trend was always upwards. Moreover, she never stayed long in the deeps. Thus, in this case, a few days after she had written to Spofford in terms of despair, telling him that the book must stop and that she can do no more now, if ever, she is writing to him at length about it, planning in detail for the second edition. It is a long letter in which eager interest in her work and careful consideration of business details alternate with doubt and fear, and a feeling, not untouched with bitterness, over the actions of some of her students. Writing under date, Fairhaven, April 19, 1877, she says, quote, "My dear student, I will consider the arrangements for embellishing the book. I had fixed on the picture of Jesus and a sick man, the hand of the former outstretched to him as in rebuke of the disease. or Waves and an Ark. The last will cost less, I conclude, and do as well. No rainbow can be made to look right except in colors, and that cannot be conveniently arranged in gilt. Now for the printing. Would 480 pages include the key to scriptures and the entire work as it now is? The book entitled Science and Health is to embrace the chapter on physiology all the same as if this chapter was not compiled in a separate volume. Perhaps you so understand it. If the cost is what you stated, I advise you to accept the terms, for I am confident in the sale of 2 editions more. There can be a net income over and above all. If I get my health again, I can make a large demand for the book, for I shall lecture, and this will sell 1 edition of 1,000 copies, if I can stand it. I am better, some. One circumstance I will name. The night before I left, and before I wrote you those fragments, Miss Brown went into convulsions from a chemical, and was not expected to live, but came out of it saying she felt perfectly well, and as well as before the injury supposed to have been received. I thought at that time, if she was not born again, the mother would die in her labors. Oh, how little my students can know what it all costs me. Now, I thank you for relieving me a little in the other case. Please see her 2x a week. In healing, you are benefiting yourself. In teaching, you are benefiting others. I would not advise you to change business at present. The rolling stone gathers no moss. Persevere in one line, and you can do much more than to continually scatter your fire. Try to get students into the field as practitioners, and thus healing will sell the book and introduce the science more than aught but my lecturing can do. Send the name of any you can get to study for the purpose of practicing, and in 6 months or thereabouts, we will have them in the field helping you. If you have ears to hear, you will understand. Send all letters to Boston. T.O. Gilbert will forward them to me at present. Now, for the writings you named, I will make an arrangement with you to publish the book the 3 years from the time you took it, and have 25% royalty paid me. At the end of this period, we will make other arrangements, or continue those we have made, just as the Spirit shall direct me. I feel this is the best thing for the present to decide upon. During these years, we shall have a treasurer, such as we shall agree upon, and the funds deposited in his or her hands and drawn for specified purposes. At the end of these 3 years, if we dissolve the partnership, the surplus amount shall be equally divided between us, and this is the best I can do. All the years I have expended on that book, the labor I am still performing, and all I have done for students and the cause gratuitously, entitle me to some income now that I am unable to work. But as it is, I have none, and instead am sued for $2,700. For what? For just this. I have allowed my students to think I have no rights, and they cannot wrong me. May God open their eyes at length. If you conclude not to carry the work forward on the terms named, it will have to go out of edition, as I can do no more of it. And I believe this hour is to try my students, who think they have the cause at heart, and see if it be so. My husband is giving all his time and means to help me get up from the depths in which these students plunge me, and this is all he can do at present. Please write soon. As ever, Mary. End quote. The letter is typical and presents a picture clear enough of the problems which confronted Mrs. Eddy at this time and of the way in which their burden was added to by doubts and fears, both her own and those of her students, which a fuller insight was at length to dissipate. The letter also shadows forth a difficulty which was to present itself at every turn in the future. A difficulty with which the leader in almost any cause is apt to be confronted. That of finding disciples with the capacity to grasp a vision and with sufficient faithfulness to follow a leader without demand for a place, either at his right hand or his left. Spofford, though, had a mind of his own, already fundamentally alienated by the blow to his feelings involved in Mary's marriage. He probably was none too sympathetic or cooperative. His reply to the letter, just quoted, was to the effect that he saw no favorable prospect at all for the second edition, that the royalty she asked for was excessive, and that he could not possibly undertake the work on those terms. At first glance, it might appear that he was, in a large measure, justified in his contention as to the royalty. In ordinary circumstances, 25% would be high royalty, and one seldom enjoyed, but the circumstances were not ordinary. Practically all Spofford's sales were and would be at the full published price. In other words, he would not have to meet the 30% or 40% discount to the bookseller, such as a publisher usually has to write off, in addition to the author's royalty and cost of production, before he can begin to reckon his own profit. Thus, even after paying the 25% royalty which Mrs. Eddy asked for, he would still stand to make at least a 20% higher profit than a regular publisher could have expected. In answer to his complaint, Mrs. Eddy wrote that she thought what she asked for was just, that over against the capital he was investing, she had given 3 years and more of work. Spofford's reply to this was to close out the remaining copies of the first edition at what he could get for them and turn over the proceeds, approximately $600, to George Berry and Elizabeth Newhall, the two students who, it will be recalled, advanced the money, over $2,000, for the publishing of the book, and had not yet been reimbursed. Spofford, too, had contributed about $500 to the project. This left Mrs. Eddy without any copies of her book and no funds with which to secure even a reprint. Much disturbed, she returned immediately to Lynn, and when Spofford called upon her, at her request, to talk the whole matter over, neither minced words, if we are to judge by their letters to each other, still extant, and the results which followed, for their partnership was rudely terminated. It was a bitter blow, not so much because of its effect upon her book, that she must have seen could be remedied, but because of the further evidence it seemed to supply of the malignity of this strange power that was able to turn her friends into enemies. First Richard Kennedy, and now Daniel Spofford. If they had just gone out from her, it would have been bad enough. But she and her little band were positive that both Kennedy and Spofford were now actively engaged in a mental opposition, the results of which might well prove disastrous. Mrs. Eddy determined to do what she could to offset the effects of the onslaught. She was beginning to perceive what is today so generally acknowledged, that mesmerism, in all its forms, from the public exhibition of direct hypnosis to mass mesmerism as practiced by the skilled propagandist, is effective in proportion to the ignorance of its subject. And so, in the second edition of her book, she determined to tackle the question thoroughly. In many ways, this second edition of Science and Health, which was published early in 1878 by Dr. Asa G. Eddy, reflects the stress and confusion amid which it first saw the light of print. A slim book of 167 pages against the 456 of the first edition, it consists of 5 chapters against the 8 in the first edition. Of these 5, the first and second, entitled respectively Imposition and Demonstration and Physiology, are chapters 2 and 7 in the first edition, while of the remaining 3, all quite short, the first, chapter 3, is entitled Mesmerism, the second, chapter 4, Metaphysics, and the last, chapter 5, Reply to a Clergyman. In its makeup, the book follows the form suggested by Mrs. Eddy in her letter to Spofford, save that, instead of a frontispiece representing Jesus healing a sick man, is a line drawing, not too badly executed, of Jesus raising Jairus' daughter, while the outside cover is embellished with a floating arc done in gilt line. It is full of typographical errors. More than 30 are listed in the errata, and there are many others. The numbers of the pages are sometimes repeated, and the title of the book appears correctly only on the outside cover. The probabilities are that the book was rushed into print in order to secure the earliest possible publication of Mrs. Eddy's statement on mesmerism, which, as already noted, appears in the second edition as Chapter 3. This statement, in view of the circumstances in which it was written, has an interest all its own. Today, viewed strictly from a psychological standpoint, it may seem at times elementary, but as a product of 60 years ago, it reveals an insight into the processes of the human mind, then almost a virgin field for research, which must be accounted remarkable. The application of her findings to her teaching is, of course, her own and unique. Her great desire was to forearm by forewarning. As she saw the matter, foreknowledge in the case of mesmerism was just as sure a protection against deception as the foreknowledge that twice two is four is an inevitable protection against the deception that twice two is anything else. But there still lingers the old bugaboo of malignant telepathic bombardment. Quote, "The best mode of self-protection from this mental outlaw," she writes in the second edition, "is to understand metaphysics and get your eyes open to the fact of what he is attempting. Then you are safe, and his malevolent attempts through a mental process to harm you are futile. His mind cannot influence yours, causing motives, resolutions, loves and hates, purposes and acts that you would never have known but for him, when you know what he is about, and his attempt will be powerless and fall before you a pitiful spectacle of defeated malice that can no more affect you than the bullet that strikes against the armor of steel. Ancient magic, sorcery, and whatever method employed by the modern modes or secret impregnation of thought by the unscrupulous manipulator and subtle mesmerist." End quote. This doctrine, so strange today, but so plausible then, of the mental transmission of evil, was to recede steadily as the years rolled thence onward. While Mrs. Eddy was writing thus in the fall of 1877, the suit against her, instituted by George Berry, had come up at last for trial, and she found arrayed against her as witnesses in support of Berry not only Daniel Spofford, but several others who had at one time been her devoted friends. Perhaps subpoenas left them no alternative, but it must have been, nonetheless, galling. It was, for her, the first of many similar experiences. She had been really fond of Berry, and he of her. He was the first of her students to call her mother, and in the days of his devotion had written a little poem, not without merit, emphasizing his debt to her. "O mother mine, God grant I ne'er forget, whatever be my grief or what my joy, the unmeasurable, inextinguishable debt I owe to thee, but find my sweet employ ever through thy remaining days to be to thee as faithful as thou wast to me." However viewed, the suit was a sorry business and a strange commentary on human nature. By the time counsel had finished reading the plaintiff's bill of particulars, it was evident that Barry desired to take up the position that in all of the 8 or 9 years he had been associated with Mrs. Eddy, he had never received from her any value, even such as could be made to offset the carrying up of a bucket of coals from the cellar, for which service he charged at the rather high rate of 50 cents a bucket. But then, as has been seen, practically everything was included, even walking out with her in the evening when they went house hunting before the purchase of No. 8 Broad Street. Mrs. Eddy went on to the stand and told of her relationship, saying she had taken him when he was a lad little more than 18, taught him practically everything he knew, even how to write properly, that she had remitted half his fees when he went through her first class, and that he had begged her to be allowed to copy her manuscripts in order that he might the better study them, some of which Barry admitted under cross-examination by Mrs. Eddy's counsel. The jury was in a quandary. It was possible that the relationship existing between the two was, as Mrs. Eddy contended, one of reciprocal service. But to what extent, it was difficult to decide. The verdict of $350 in Barry's favor, ultimately tendered, was a compromise and represented compensation only for the actual copying of portions of Science and Health for the printer. Mrs. Eddy saw in it all simply the malign effects of mesmerism, as she called it. This is evident from her handling of the matter in the second edition of Science and Health. She reasoned soundly enough that there can be no such thing as a falsehood that has not an antecedent truth, but that the falsehood, like any other falsehood, would operate as truth until it was shown to be a falsehood. All of which was, of course, but a logical deduction from the admitted fact that the mesmerist is powerless in the presence of an understanding denial of his power. And so, when the second edition of Science and Health at last appeared in January of 1878, it was found to contain the vigorous denunciation of mesmerism and mesmerists already referred to. The result was an immediate and very sharp separation of the sheep from the goats. Spofford and Barry, for the time being at any rate, were classed with Kennedy, while those remaining were pronounced loyal. The movement was growing much more rapidly than appeared on the surface. But even on the surface, it was presenting to an increasing extent tangible evidence of its existence. The little Christian Scientist's home on Broad Street in Lynn, the Christian Science Publishing Company, and the Christian Scientist Association, which had been organized chiefly through the efforts of Spofford in the summer of 1876, were all evidence that a movement was afoot. It was this last, the Christian Scientist Association, that now, with ironic justice or injustice, took action against Spofford. Under their rules of order, he was now declared expelled for immorality. Notice to this effect was published in the Newburyport Herald. His retort was a letter to that paper stating he could not be expelled from the association as he had never been a member. To which Mrs. Eddy, always quick in response, contradicted his assertion and elaborated on the charges against him. Quote, "Our Constitution requires," she wrote, "when a member is expelled for immorality, that it should be made public." The motive for this article in the Constitution was to prevent a member from going astray, or, in case this could not be prevented, to forewarn the community, so ignorant of the evil that can be done by this student, of the secret agent for mischief that a mental malpractice becomes. The time is not far off when the witnesses to the secret sins, yea, crimes, committed in the name of science, and those who have been the unconscious victims of such abuses, will be heard in our halls of state. And because a man heals in some instances, as all mesmerists do, and does incalculable evil in others, he will not blindly be upheld by the sick and pin his wicked deeds on the better deed that the one may offset the other, or make science and health the pretense for such malpractice. May the direct line of duty, from which I never swerve, be taken by those of our worthy students, as we know it will be finally, and truth will triumph over error. End quote. There were more letters and statements and questions from George Berry and Elizabeth Newhall, with a vigorous rejoinder from Miranda Rice. But Spofford did not return to the attack. It was not long, however, before Mrs. Eddy was called upon to face even more difficult issues.